Londoners today are comparing their reactions to the resumption of the real night raids. People who have returned to London since last fall are at something of a disadvantage because no matter how hard the night raids become, in the minds of people who've lived in London continuously since the Blitz began, they'll never be as bad as those first big September raids. In any discussion of bombing, there's a tendency among these veterans to become a little supercilious when they talk to country cousins or other Londoners who missed the September attacks. In fact, you might almost say that 5 or 6 million people could, in some circumstances, be called bomb snobs. And when a newcomer mentions bombing, he's likely to hear someone say, "Oh, yes, of course, but were you here during the big raids in September?" "No, I remember," and the newcomer is properly squelched. One London paper describing Saturday's raids under the headline, "It Seemed Like Old Times," tells of a conversation between a couple of policemen. A bomb whistled down a few hundred yards away, and both policemen fell on their faces. When they picked themselves up, one said, "I wonder if we'd have fallen down like that last September." His comrade said, "I don't think so. We had a sort of bomb sense. After the first few nights, I could tell to a few yards where they were going to land. I suppose it'll come back again." The first policeman said, "It's like learning to swim or ride a bicycle. You don't forget." Outside London, last night's attacks were scattered. Bombs dropped in the home counties, the south coast of England, various other points in England, and in northeast Scotland. Despite the fact that military attention has turned for the moment toward the Balkans and the Near East, it would be silly to imagine that the attempted invasion of Britain isn't a very real and, with the coming of spring, an imminent probability. Lieutenant General Sir Ronald Adam, the commander-in-chief of the Northern Command, emphasized this yesterday in an interview with war correspondents. He said the Germans must attempt an invasion in the next few months or lose the war. He said the Germans couldn't succeed in their task if the British kept their heads. General Adam didn't say the Germans couldn't make a landing. Military opinion here is prepared to see the Germans succeed in getting ashore at points on the coast. The point is that after they land, the British expect to drive them out, and General Adams stressed the necessity for tanks to accomplish this. The general forecast that enemy troops would make many isolated feints to prepare for mass attacks elsewhere, and he thought the rest of the country would remain comparatively undisturbed. The British press today is openly jubilant about the Lease Land Bill's success in the Senate. It is a matter of vital importance to Britain, and the papers treat it as such. One paper says that the measure alters the whole aspect of the war and calls it a famous victory. The Evening Standard says that Hitler conducted a major campaign to immobilize the United States. It spent precious dollars on propaganda and espionage and spread his tentacles among the ramifications of American industry. Today, the Standard continues, we celebrate the decisive defeat of this plan. No one could have foretold such a result when Hitler sent his tanks rattling through the Ardennes. They broke down a rampart far more solidly constructive and far more patiently designed than the Maginot Line. Today, America knows that her interest is so surely bound with ours that the government in Washington will pay for supplies to be sent to us from money drawn from the American taxpayer. The Atlantic is no longer a rampart. It is broken wide open and has become the chief battlefield. Another afternoon paper says the firm resolve of the Senate and the American people to give Britain the tools to finish the job earns Britain's greatest gratitude, but it warns the British not to be complacent, but to remember that God and the United States help those who help themselves. The Star emphasized that the future welfare and happiness of the world depends on a lasting understanding between Britain and the United States, and says the least honor the British can pay to America is to strive to understand the point of view, the ideals, traditions, and aspirations of the American people. This is John McVane in London, returning you to the National Broadcasting Company in New York.
That's the report from London on this morning's European roundup of news. Next, for our report from the Reich, we take you to Berlin.
Hello, NBC. This is Theodore Knaut speaking from Berlin. After an uneventful weekend, which did not bring further adherence to the three-power pact as many had expected, the chief news here is the announcement that the Land and Lease Bill has passed the Senate and gone back to the House of Representatives for final passage. The debates are over, and they have attracted much attention here, particularly the speeches of the opposition senators. The fact that Senator Nye spoke no less than 5 times is noted in the Fürkische Beobachter, which does not, however, draw the obvious conclusion that opponents of the measure have had every opportunity of saying their say. The Frankfurter Zeitung draws an interesting parallel between Lord Halifax, Britain's new ambassador in Washington, and America's John G. Wynand, who has just arrived in London. The British ambassador, an aristocrat, is said to be sending British conservatism westward to America, whereas Mr. Wynand, as a new dealer, is bringing American socialistic progress eastward to England, the two moving on separate single tracks, so to speak. It will be up to the tactician Roosevelt, the paper says, to keep them apart and to prevent a mix-up. The last echoes of the report in a Hungarian National Socialist paper about Mr. Roosevelt's alleged offer to guarantee the integrity of Yugoslavia are dying away, as Italian papers are quoted with their comments on the assumed move in Washington. With the approaching passage of the Aid to England Bill, and with Yugoslavia hanging off as a signatory of the three-power pact, the incident is fading out in its significance, but it certainly kept the press busy for a few days. Vichy is in the news again, at least so far as talk along the Wilhelmstrasse is concerned. The visit of General Weygand to Vichy is noted here, but comment on it has been withheld, and now it seems that Laval, too, has crossed over to unoccupied France, ostensibly to visit his home there, but taking the opportunity, apparently, to get in touch with the government, too. It is believed that the conversations conducted by General Weygand concerned French colonial policy, especially as to French equatorial Africa. Syria, too, is in the news, reports being circulated here constantly of alleged British plans to seize the mandated French territory, whose importance, of course, lies in the fact that it lies on the road that leads from Bulgaria to Suez. The Arabs are said here to be determined to resist a British attempt to occupy Syria. From Athens, we learn that there is at the moment no change in the relations of Greece and Germany. The two are still diplomatically on normal terms. Nor can anything be said about a rumored German non-aggression pact with Yugoslavia. I have a private report from Belgrade that a visit of state to Germany is coming soon, but confirmation here cannot be obtained. But food shipments to France and Belgium always meet with responsive comment here, and the Christian attitude of Lord Halifax in denying British assistance in getting food to those stricken countries comes in for scathing comment here. So does President Roosevelt for his remark that there was plenty of food in America for people at home and for their democratic friends, the inference being that non-democratic nations would be starved into surrender of their principles. The question of whether Germany would assist France if it tried to protect its food shipments with its own warships is passed over is not acute as yet. The German Air Force attacked London in a big way last night, the German High Command announces, wave after wave of German planes appearing over the city and discharging their missiles in what is said to have been one of the biggest attacks in a long time, although the weather was anything but favorable. Portsmouth, with its government shipbuilding yards, was also attacked, and large fires were observed there as a result of the raid. Other German planes were over Scotland, where they damaged two ships, as well as another south of Plymouth. In numerous places, airports were bombed, and as usual, Malta received its daily attacks. The British made no attempts yesterday to enter Germany. This is Theodore Knaut, speaking from Berlin and returning you to NBC.
Now, here is Earl Godwin reporting from the NBC newsroom in Washington.
Good morning, folks. The lease land bill, finished by both houses, will be on the president's desk Tuesday night if they can speed up some of the clerical and legislative routine details. The House will take up the measure tomorrow under a rule which will give it the right of way, and the motion will be to concur in the Senate amendments. Saul Bloom, who's chairman of the Foreign Affairs Committee, is my authority for that statement, and he has the bill in hand and the time to dispense. That is a motion, a forward motion for speed. Representative Hamilton Fish, New York Republican, says he's going to try to get the Anti-American Expeditionary Force Amendment up for debate again and into the bill, but under the rule tomorrow, there will be only 1 hour for debate, and Mr. Fish will have only 30 minutes of that hour, and everybody doubts that he can muster sufficient strength in half an hour. The president's signature Tuesday night or Wednesday morning, if he's satisfied with the bill, will be like pushing the button for one of these gigantic power plants. Only nothing on earth so powerful has ever been turned on before as the entire industrial, financial, economic strength of the nation, which concentrates for this lease-lend purpose under the president's right hand, Jove himself and his comparatively minor Olympic Mountain Thunderbolt Ford shop becomes a peanut piker in contrast to the President Roosevelt and the power to aid Britain, Greece, China, anybody. One of the details, of course, being discussed today is just what aid will go first, warships or what? Will we trade any warships for what? Britain's needs, as reported last week, were cargo boats first, planes second, destroyers third, and an unlimited stream of arms and munitions of all kinds. There is also a limit of $1.3 billion worth on the amount of American material out of current appropriations that can be given right away to Britain. After that, the President will come back to Congress whenever it's necessary for appropriations. Whatever happens then is up to Mr. Roosevelt, and he and his closest advisors have been very close-mouthed about it. The President alone, according to the bill, has the power to answer all these questions as to how much and what type of equipment will be made available for the democracies, or whether the United States shall become an international larder to feed the democracies as well as arm them. Incidentally, this morning, Britain says no to Herbert Hoover's proposal for food soup kitchens for Belgium. The first move could well be the release of present Army and Navy equipment listed as surplus. Incidentally, it was Army and Navy surplus that refitted the British Army after Dunkirk when they were absolutely bare of arms. Ex-destroyers, now classified as something else than destroyers, are scheduled for early consideration and possibly transfer to Britain. And while they're waiting, the lawyers here are arguing in the clubrooms and cloakrooms as to whether the President can order American naval vessels for convoy duty. I happen to be one of those non-lawyers who've always believed the President as Commander-in-Chief could order the Navy anywhere at all at any time. But those opposed tell me that ordering the battleships, the cruisers, or the destroyers out for convoy duty would be over and above anything that the Constitution contemplated, and that it would be a plain act of war. However, that is one of the things which is going to be discussed, and we will hear from it later. Now Earl Godwin says goodbye. That's the news from Washington at this time.
And that's the news on this Monday morning, March 10th. Reports from London and Berlin have been heard, and just concluded was Earl Godwin's digest from Washington of latest developments at home. This is the National Broadcasting Company.